The committee will come to order. There's two bills up today. But first, we have the minutes from the February 26th meeting. Representative Gottwald will move
to the minutes.
Any questions? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And now we'll just wait a minute here for our authors to show up. Just so people know about next week, where Representative Huntley is donating his time to us from Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, so we'll actually go for, you know, 3 hours or what have you next week in for the policy committee to process bills. So we'll actually probably, you know, do the same thing where we take the first half hour to caucuses, individual caucuses, so it'll likely be 1:30, but we'll get more details out about that. But just so people know, we'll be meeting for the both committee hearing times next week. All right, Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon.
And I will move House File 419, that it be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. And there's also a delete all amendment that we might as well do right now. Does that make sense?
If you would, please. That would get the bill in the order that I would appreciate.
The DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. I'll move that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As members may be seeing in recent both media and research reports, we're showing real progress in reducing children's exposure to lead and to their blood lead levels. These positive reports are the result of more than 20 years of hard work by providers, by public health advocates, and by policymakers. At the same time, however, I think it's fair to say that research is showing increasingly that there is no safe level or exposure to lead for our youngest citizens. House File 419, as you just amended it then, within existing resources, aims to lower the blood level, lead level at which providers need to respond and establish a protocol in law for that response for that child and that child's family. Mr. Chair, with me today is Mr. Samuel Yaman from the MCEA. And he can he has a PowerPoint presentation, if you would.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Representative Dabney stated, I'm Samuel Yaman, public health scientist with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And we're just working here. Sounds like we got the PowerPoint presentation underway. I did also have some handout materials for committee members. We'll get started anyway. Basic purpose of House File 419, which is a very simple piece of legislation, is to change the definition of children's elevated blood lead level from 10 micrograms of lead in a deciliter of blood to 5 micrograms per deciliter. I will speak a bit about why this is necessary and how it would fit with existing lead poisoning prevention programs. The toxic effects of excessive lead exposure on the human brain and nervous system have been recognized for centuries. During the second half of the 20th century, became increasingly evident that lower exposures to lead can also cause lasting impacts on intelligence and behavior, even when the dose is not immediately life-threatening. Higher exposure to lead have been identified as a risk factor for dropping out of high school, as well as for juvenile delinquency, criminal arrest, etc. Young children in particular are susceptible to the health risks of lead. And as Representative Dabney pointed out, and as many people here already know, over the past 40 years, great progress has been made in reducing the number of children with excessively high exposures to lead and also in reducing the average lead exposures across the whole of the American population. Yet, some unfinished business remains in the area of lead exposure prevention. The most widespread source of exposure today is lead paint, Lead was banned from paint production in 1978, but the paint is still present in and around many older homes. Young children are at higher risk because they tend to play and crawl in dust or soils that may contain lead, and sometimes can put lead paint chips directly into their mouth. Additionally, young children's brain and nervous system are undergoing rapid development. The neurotoxic effects of lead can last throughout their lifetimes. The exposure limit we're talking about is derived from the Centers for Disease Control, the federal CDC. And children's risk from lead is typically assessed by testing the concentration of lead in their blood, which in turn reflects their exposure to lead in the environment. CDC and other public health agencies publish guidelines for blood lead testing and recommend public health actions to be taken at each exposure threshold. The lowest of these regulatory thresholds, the one that this bill addresses, is 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. This concentration is the CDC level of concern and is enforced in Minnesota as the elevated blood lead level. Beneath this level, no substantive public health actions are required. However, CDC has acknowledged that current science demonstrates that this standard is not sufficiently protective of children's health and development. This slide shows the CDC level of concern over time. Reflects the fact that over the past 40 years, science has repeatedly shown that blood lead concentrations that were once believed to be safe are actually toxic to children's developing brain and nervous system. Back in the 1960s, a concentration of 60 micrograms per deciliter of blood was considered elevated. Since then, the CDC has reduced its acceptable exposure limit four times due to scientific evidence of harm. At each of those milestones, when the weight of scientific evidence showed that children's health is impacted at levels below the previous CDC benchmark, the agency responded by lowering that benchmark. And in 1991, which was the last time that CDC adjusted this standard, the agency explained that this was the lower level of the range at which effects had been identified. Today we know that health effects occur below that standard. And just a quick review of some of the science that has been published in the journal literature, because there's a lot of it. Studies published in recent years have shown that exposures below the 10 micrograms exposure limit are linked to intellectual impairments. These are quantified by significantly lower scores on IQ tests, as well as on other tests of cognitive ability, brain function, academic aptitude, normal psychological and neurologic development. The impacts of exposures below the standard are also reflected in tests of children's academic aptitude and even on their scores that public schools apply to assess children's performance in reading and math.
And we need to finish up this part of it in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Your presentation, but not the bill, but your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can certainly accommodate that. Just quickly, more of the research that's been published in recent years has also found that lead exposures in this relatively lower range are also associated with a attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Estimates put this these levels of lead as related to up to 300,000 cases in the U.S., which is not only an unfortunate condition, but also can be quite costly to families and the healthcare system. I'll also just touch briefly upon some of the other economic impacts of these ongoing lead exposures.
even today's lead exposures, which as we noted, are relatively lower than in the past, and that's great news. But the part that's unfinished business is that economic estimates still put today's exposures to lead. The economic impacts are in the billions of dollars, and at least $40 billion per year for the U.S. economy is lost due to lost productivity when children who are exposed to lead become adults of working age. I'll just touch briefly also on some of the disparities. These, again, are persisting in terms of the children that are exposed to levels of lead that impact their intellectual function and overall development. African-American children as a group are the hardest hit. And more generally, children of lower income households of any racial or ethnic background are still the ones that are bearing the brunt of the remaining part of the lead problem that we still need to tackle. Just a brief summary of the actions that are proposed with this legislation. When a child's blood lead level does exceed 5 micrograms per deciliter, the bill proposes a few simple yet cost-effective public health actions, which represent a good investment in our future, being, you know, helping children reach their potential, not having impacts on their brain and intellect, academic and work performance. So the way that the bill proposes to help work on that is by proposing thorough family education on potential sources of lead and on ways to avoid exposure. This means simply providing literature and having the healthcare provider explain it and make sure the family understands how they can take simple steps to figure out what may be the cause of the lead exposure and how to avoid that in the future. And then a follow-up blood test to just make sure that the after a few months that whatever measures were taken are sending the child's exposure level back down and not up into the higher range of exposures, for example, over 10 micrograms, which we now know today is a lot more serious than we thought it was even 20 years ago. And similarly, just to make sure that other young children under 5 years of age also get a blood test to make sure that they're not exposed to the same level or even higher. Some of the things that the legislation does not attempt to address are the other higher regulatory thresholds already in place that trigger more intensive interventions, risk assessment, home inspections. Any of these more intensive measures that are necessary at the higher levels, but at these lower levels, while there is a hazard, the bill is just proposing some really cost-effective basic public health measures. And I just put this sheet up on the screen. I included this in the packet of materials for committee members. This is an example of how existing guidance might change to reflect this legislation. And I recognize that, you know, it's not really readable up there on the screen, but I just put it there for the purpose of showing that this is a very focused and targeted piece of legislation. It's not attempting to say that all the actions on this table of guidelines should be taking place at this 5 to 10 micrograms level, but just a few targeted actions that would be really helpful in addressing this level of exposures.
Thank you. Questions?
I can conclude now, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
So, just to, Subdivision 12 is a new subdivision. These aren't guidelines. Is this creating something that's different than a guideline like listed in here? It sounds like this is more than a guideline in a sense.
Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the amendment reflects what's in those guidelines. It was deemed necessary for more clarity within the proposed legislation in terms of what actions should actually be taken. And so the other sheet that I put up on the screen and in your packet was a earlier example of, you know, based on existing guidelines of what would be different.
And I guess my question is, are these guidelines that was on the screen, this document, is that in statute anywhere?
Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding the question correctly, this is a document that was up on the screen that's from MDH that is the protocol for currently for a child who tests above 10.
And I guess my question, just to be clear about it, is, and we talked about this a little bit, Resident Dabney, it looks like what we're doing in the statute now is saying, putting a requirement on providers in statute that doesn't currently exist either at 5 or 10 micrograms, and a requirement in statute is different than a guideline, and that's the kind of question. I just want to clarify that I'm right about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you were right about that, and the existing guidance sheet that you have there, which is based on the Minnesota Department of Health guidelines, that was developed by the agency, as is often the case, developing guidelines based on a much more concise directive in the statute. Okay. And again, so it was deemed necessary in this case to do the amendment because there seemed to be a need for more clarity within the statute rather than in the guidance itself.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Any other questions, members? Representative Garter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Yaman, for the bill's author, I'm just curious what would trigger someone to get tested for lead for their child? I mean, is there some warning sign, or do you focus on a particular area? Or say if you've got paint chips in your house, you know, you probably have every child tested for lead. I'm just curious how the kids will get screened, what actually gets them to get screened.
Either of you, yes.
I can start, and Mr. Yaman can flesh out. Mr. Chair, Representative Garter, my experience with two children is it was a routine part of their pediatric well child visit at a certain point. It was a scary moment when, with my younger child, they asked, you know, is any exposure to lead? And, of course, I said no. And they said, you know, have you done any, you know, work around the house? It would kick up any dust. And, of course, we had just completed a major renovation project. And it never even occurred to me that with an older home, that renovation project for a new bedroom and an expansion of some other parts of the house could be a source of lead exposure to my son. He tested fine, even below the 5 threshold. But my experience has been that it's a normal protocol for child well child visits.
And I'll just add to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner. There are guidelines that come from the CDC and are also promoted by Minnesota Department of Health and American Academy of Pediatrics. Certain groups are especially targeted for testing, and those are groups of children that are known to be at high risk, children in the inner cities and areas where there's older housing, children that are known to be at risk for this due to being from lower-income households and so on. So there's targeted groups that public health departments and healthcare providers are advised to test, and certainly, you know, you can go beyond that if there's other reasons where you feel that the child may need to be tested. And our position really, as long as there are guidelines that say, here are recommendations for testing certain groups of children, here are certain actions that you should take based on different levels of lead in the blood, we feel that framework should reflect most current best available science. And just as in past decades, the policy has lagged behind the science, and we're hoping to bring just this part of the framework for testing up to date with what science says about the health risks.
Have you had discussions with the department or with the Department of Health on, are they not moving their guidelines?
Mr. Chair, the Department of Health has not spoken with me.
Okay. Are they here today? Anybody? Okay. If anybody, you don't have to come down now, but you might want to, or you can if you want. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Brummer. I'm the Acting Division Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. One of our programs is the blood surveillance program, and the question is whether or not we've been watching this bill. We don't dispute that lead is bad, but the question has always been resources. As we lower the number, do we have the resources to go in and remediate those problems? The guidelines that Mr. Yaman is looking at has shown to you, those were negotiated with the Minnesota Medical Association, and it wasn't just, oh, these are guidelines that would be nice to follow. The staff who worked with the Medical Association worked, it was a consensus committee effort to try and come up with agreed upon action levels. And so I would say they really are more than just a passing guideline. And we would have to go back. If they got changed, we would go back to the Medical Association and negotiate with them.
Rickman Bunn, you had a question. Okay. My question is, if you have a question, go ahead. Okay, go, please.
Thank you. So following up to what you just said, Ms. Bremner, what year did you negotiate these guidelines?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at staff. 2006.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn.
Okay.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you. How many other states have a lower than 10 guideline, or is there any movement at the federal level to advocate for such a thing?
Mr. Chair, if I might, could I have staff answer these more
sure.
detailed questions?
Yes.
Mr. Yaman has also been following the CDC's, has had some committee work on this, as I understand, so he could respond as well. Take a number.
The question is,
Mr. Chair, I'm Eric is able with the lead program.
Welcome to the committee.
And I would ask you if you could please.
The question is, Representative Bunn, please.
The question is, how many other states currently have any level established in their guidelines below 10, and whether or not there's any movement at the federal level to move that guideline to a lower level, right, or advocate for it?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are a state funded to do our work basically by CDC, and there are approximately 40 states that have a similar program, and they, for the most part, they follow the guidance that CDC has put out, which is basically the same as what ours is. So to make that simple, most of the states do use a 10.
Mm-hmm.
There are some states, I believe Vermont is one state that has dropped what they consider a level of concern down to 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there are two cities that also.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a different, back to an earlier topic, it still isn't clear to me to what extent children going through the general health care system actually get at some point, and there will be the checkups, this happening to them. It sounds like it depends. There's some guidelines, and so it's up to the physician to determine whether they think they're a targeted group and therefore they do it. Then specifically, those children in our state that are receiving medical assistance or under Minnesota care, do we have any more, is it more likely, or doesn't practice it absolutely happen as a matter of course, that they would receive this testing or not? And then related to that last point, do we have any sense of what the cost impact, if in fact, you know, on the state would be of this proposal, if in fact it, you know, somehow changes the amount of testing or those who will be tested?
And Representative Dabney, you're going to get a fiscal note on this, I presume, at some point to address that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biden, the fiscal note will be coming. The amendment that you all put on the bill today does narrow the fiscal impact of the proposal. We're hopeful. We are mindful of limited resources. We're also mindful of the impact of lead on children.
Yeah.
To my final question, is there someone from here from Human Services or Health that can answer a question about whether it's a matter of course children who are on MA or on Minnesota Care receive such testing sometimes?
There's someone right at the table.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I can answer that to a certain extent. In our guidelines, we do recommend that all children who are on Medicaid or the state program should be tested, both at age one and at age two, and we actually have done some studies to see if that is actually happening, and we have found that in 2007, about 40% of those kids were actually tested. But that is actually a significant improvement.
Mr. Brown, do you want to testify briefly? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. First, I want to apologize to the author if I've not had a chance to talk to him. As we were looking at the bills introduced, it was something that we were comfortable with and we thought was appropriate. We've had discussions within our own association about what the appropriate level is, and there has been a move from many physicians saying that the five level is the appropriate level. I think I would not disagree with most of the testimony given earlier. Our concern, however, with the bill is you have now putting into statute a standard. And historically, we have resisted doing that in statute. We have left the standard of care to the individual physicians based on the community standard that is defined by the Board of Medical Practice and others. Once you start putting into statute, here's the type of things you must do. If there are changes in the standard of care, this is now set in law. We have had some experience of that. If you recall, a few years ago, with the whole issue of bone marrow transplants for breast cancer, which we put in the state law, was soon realized that was inappropriate, and now many would say if you do that, it would probably be malpractice. Regardless of whether this is the right standard and the right types of things to do, we would discourage you from putting this specific language into law as a standard, as opposed to the guidelines that have been developed. Generally, what physicians look at guidelines, and they will try to follow those. We will try to promote those. We have been trying to promote those through our association and working with the Department of Health, but we would oppose putting this kind of standard into state law.
When do you start? How do negotiations over the guidelines start, or is that an ongoing process, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I don't know if I can answer that question. I know we have a public health committee that looks at these issues. We had a resolution come through our House of Delegates dealing with the same issue this past September. So there is a move. This is to talk about maybe the five micrograms is the right level. I just don't. And again, regardless of whether the number is 5 or 10, we would, even if it were at 10, we would discourage you and ask you not to put this kind of standard into law.
And I guess one other question for Representative Dabney that I have, or for Mr. Renner. At 10 micrograms, is there the same, under the guidelines, is there a follow-up requirement? or Mr. Yaman?
I'm reviewing
Dr.
these, Mr. Chair, under the guidelines as I'm reading them, at 10, yes, there is follow-up. If you're looking down the very bottom of the sheet, the follow-up slash comment section, it does include screen other children in the home and repeat the DNS test in 3 months. We're simply shifting that standard to the lower threshold.
So there would be a little X in the box if the 5 wasn't there.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Simply put.
And Mr. Chair, again, I don't think I'm not here to argue that we shouldn't be just changing the level to 5, but I think we would continue to argue that that should be done through a guideline process as opposed to putting in a hard, fast standard in state law.
Mr. Chair,
any final comment? Yeah,
I can appreciate Mr. Brenner and his organization's hesitance. I don't think the analogy to the issue around bone marrow is a good analogy. Doing a blood test to follow up on a legitimate health concern does no harm to the child. The bone marrow piece does. So I can appreciate the concern while challenging the analogy.
Mr. Chair, that's a fair challenge. I'm not suggesting either similar. I use it only as an example why we have historically tried not to put a standard of care in the law, because that standard of care may change, and then now we are held to a standard that may be out of date.
Okay. Well, any other questions or comments? I guess, you know, my encouragement here as this bill moves on is maybe we can get the health department and the MMA to sit down and see if we can figure out a way to get this into the guidelines. It sounds like everybody's in agreement that the science has moved us there.
Right.
And so it's more of a kind of how we go about doing it more than anything. So, see no further discussion. I'll renew my motion that House File 419 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. As amended. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Clark. I will move that House File 326 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And I'll also move the DE-1 amendment. That's just to get it how you want it, Representative Clark.
Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
So I'll move the DE-1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is basically, we're back again after we were here last year with phase out of a dangerous chemical in baby products by Phenyl A. And it's similar to last year's, but it's narrower. And I just want to briefly describe it to you, members, because I know you've had quite a bit of testimony about the medical impacts, the health impacts of BPA, previous testimony from expert witnesses here, I don't know, a month or so ago. But just to say that it's very narrow. It phases out the use of BPA from products that are intended for children that are age 3 and under, and those include things like baby bottles, sippy cups, toys, and infant formula containers. Since last year, I've modified the bill to become a two-pronged phase-out, and that's in order to be sensitive to the industry that was concerned about it, to be practical in moving forward as well. The phase-out date for infant formula containers is moved to be 2013. I can tell you the bill has no fiscal impact, and it's a great step to try to protect children's health. In the delete all amendment, there's two important concerns where I tighten up the language. The first, number one, I've clarified the language to be clear that the bill only covers cans used for infant formulas. This is the same language that we had last year, but to be clear that we're not including canned foods like beans and corn and so on. This came as a result of talking to some of the producers in Minnesota who were thinking it might be broader. Secondly, I've worked closely with Medtronic and have addressed an issue that they had about concerns around insulin pumps, so we exempted those products. And then we are working on language that we'll be introducing in the next committee to allow retailers to sell their existing stock of products after the enactment date. I just wanted to mention that you probably know that the Food and Drug Administration, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, made a public statement that BPA is safe some time ago. And this really brought a backlash from the scientific community. And after careful consideration and actually strong advice from their own scientists. It turned out that they had ignored hundreds of peer-reviewed studies, and now they, their own scientists have asked them to go back to the drawing boards on their position on BPH, and they are currently doing that right now. I guess I would just say when federal agencies are not protecting us, it is the job of states like Minnesota to move forward with kind of protective policies. And I'd like to ask Lindsay Bell to make a few comments, introduce herself. She's been working with me on this bill for several years now.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks for having me. My name is Lindsay Bell, and I work with Healthy Legacy, and I'll keep my comments pretty brief today, just for the interest in time, because as Representative Clark stated, Dr. Myers spent significant time in testimony before. So I just wanted to highlight a few kind of important things. First of all, Healthy Legacy is a Minnesota-based public health coalition, and we have 30 different member organizations that really range across different fields and disciplines. So we have health-affected groups like ARC and the Learning Disabilities Association. We also have groups like the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Parent Teacher Association, and the Minnesota Public Health Association. So we've come together to support this bill because we've been talking to parents across the state who are really just confused. They go to stores, and it's hard to tell which products have EPA, which ones don't. And so they're really just saying, you know what, I want to be able to go into any store and make sure that the products are free of this synthetic estrogen. I also wanted to just note that there are safer alternatives on the market already, and that are cost-effective. So you can go to Babies R Us, and I just brought a few just because it's good to kind of physically see the safer alternatives. So this, you can get a packet of three baby bottles for $2.99 at Babies R Us that are BPA-free. Again, cost-effective, already in the market. And likewise, for infant formula, there's been significant discussion about infant formula this year. These are dry powdered packets that are BPA-free. And also, finally, liquid infant formula. So there's both liquid and dry infant formula that do not contain BPA. Again, you can go to your local retailer, if you know what you're looking for, that is, to find these products. So the safer alternatives are out there, and we just need to take the significant step to decrease this exposure for the children that are most vulnerable. And then finally, I just would like to add that not only are markets moving in that direction, but parents really want to have the assurance that if they can't go to a certain retailer that's already agreed to phase them out, there's some retailers like the smaller 99-cent stores that haven't agreed to phase these products off their shelves. So we just want to make sure that everyone can have access to those safe products. And then finally, there's 14 other states that are introducing legislation that are really similar to Representative Clark's. Canada has moved to ban BPA from baby bottles. And new, kind of hot off the press, is the European Parliament is also working. They haven't yet, but they're working towards phasing this chemical out as well.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Marty Mossberg and John Wilson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marty Mountford. I am Executive Vice President of the International Formula Council. The IFC is an association of manufacturers of nutritional products, formulated nutritional products like infant formulas and medical foods. Our members are Abbott Nutrition, Mead Johnson Nutrition, Nestle Infant Nutrition, and YF Nutrition, and these companies make all of the branded infant formula sold in the United States. The association respectfully opposes HFF 326. We believe the currently available scientific evidence does not justify such a prohibition. Moreover, because few alternatives, viable alternatives, currently exist, if enacted, HFF 326 would drastically reduce the availability of infant formula for the thousands of infants in Minnesota who consume this product, safely consume this product, I might add. No government agency in the world has banned BPA in food packaging, and the World Health Organization has found no basis to issue health warnings about BPA. The US FDA, the EPA, Canada, Europe, Japan, and other countries have consistently stated there is no health risk associated with the trace amounts of BPA that potentially can be detected in infant formulas. The primary focus of the Council and its member companies is the welfare, health and welfare of infants. And the product that we make is the most highly regulated food product in the whole world. And it also continues to be the only safe alternative to breast milk. Now, most moms feed their baby infant formula sometime in the first year of life. Even moms, the many moms who breastfeed their babies, often supplement with infant formula. So passage of this bill could negatively impact the thousands of new moms in this state by making it more difficult for them to obtain a safe and nutritious product to feed their babies. We take all potential safety issues very seriously, and we support science-based efforts to produce infant formula products of the highest possible quality. Now, the materials that are used in the packaging meet all current regulatory standards. And when new information becomes available on substances like BPA, we support bringing that information forward through the accepted process of scientific peer review, regulatory review, and evaluation. In the meantime, we remain committed to working in collaboration with government and regulatory authorities to protect the health and safety of infants. And as part of this commitment, and in response to changing customer and consumer preferences, we stand ready to adopt suitable alternatives, if feasible, and if they meet or exceed the benefits of the current food packaging materials. Now, you may realize, but in case it's not obvious, infant formula manufacturers don't make the packaging for the product. So we must rely on others, including the can industry, to come up with suitable alternatives for packaging. So while the scientific evidence, we believe, continues to support the safety of BPA, we are partnering with our food packaging suppliers to further minimize the trace levels that might be contained in the current packaging. And this involves changing manufacturing and filling processes. And we're also working with the packaging industry to research and identify possible alternatives. Now, the difficulty is these steps take time. Switching to the alternative packaging is not a simple process, and it can take years. We have to work with the regulators to identify and certify alternatives, and we have to go through a number of steps to ensure that any new packaging material provides at least the same level of quality and safety provided by the current packaging. The packaging used today provides this critical protection to maintain the quality of both the container and the product for a given period of time, known as shelf life. Now, in the case of liquid products, that's about, the shelf life is usually 12 to 18 months.
Ms. Bonford?
Yes.
What about the packages that the last witness just showed us?
We cannot assure that the other types of packaging contain no BPA. There are liners that are used, like in the plastic liquid containers, as well as in the powder products that may contain traces of BPA. So, if this bill were passed,
so those packages she showed us aren't BPA free.
The
Ms. Dahl showed us.
I cannot guarantee that they are.
Okay.
Is there a foil top on it? Then it's
okay.
Not BPA.
Yeah. Are they advertised as BPA free?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, you'll come up. Okay. All right. Thanks. Well, please go on.
It's primarily if it has a foil top, as John says. So that would be the liquid that's in the plastic container. But also some of the powder products have a foil liner. And
it's a foil liner that has the BPA trace.
Potentially,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. Please continue.
Anyway, the protections that the current packaging offers are critical in preventing corrosion, environmental contamination, ensuring nutrient stability, product quality throughout the product's shelf life. And the FDA requires that all of these factors have to be accounted for before you can change to an alternative package. And although we would certainly like to speed up the process, it's you can't really speed up shelf life testing. Once we have an alternative, you're still looking at time to do the shelf life testing
So that's why we come up with that it's going to take years before we can switch to this packaging, assuming there's something that the can industry or another industry shows us is viable.
So Canada does not include infant formula packaging in their ban?
Canada? No, Canada has not banned packaging. Canada is considering banning BPA in the plastic baby bottles. Out of an abundance of caution.
Okay, and we'll get some clarification.
But they have not, no one has banned it.
In the infant formula world.
Right.
Okay, all right. Right.
So just to kind of sum up here, a compliance date of 2013 for manufacturers of infant formula containers, as proposed by this bill, could result in a large gap between the supply and demand, because it's unclear, first of all, whether there's a viable alternative, and even if there is one, then it's a long process changing the packaging, working with regulatory agencies to ensure all the everything passes muster is a lengthy process, and as it should be, because you're feeding babies. We agree with the Canadian Health Minister who recently said that the benefits of continuing to make formulas available while working to minimize exposure to BPA would serve the best interests of public health and consumers. So in summary, consistent with current scientific consensus on the safety of BPA and to preserve Minnesota parents and caregivers' infant feeding options, we urge this committee to defer further action on HF 326. There are well-established national and international processes in place for evaluating the safety of products and substances like BPA, and we encourage the committee to allow the scientific and regulatory review process, which is currently underway, to be completed before taking action. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and comment today.
Questions, members? Representative Gardner? No. Oh, okay. Mr. Ross. Dr. Ross, is that
right? Yes, Dr. Ross.
Ross, sorry. Okay,
sorry. Thank you. I'm Dr. John Ross. I'm here representing the North American Metal Packaging Alliance, and I have submitted testimony. What I really wanted to do is just cover a couple of issues that have been discussed today. The use of epoxy coatings has been used in metal packaging for over 50 years, used safely for over 50 years. The reason is it just plain works. It protects the food that's packed in that metal packaging. In today's environment, when we see all of these stories about foodborne illnesses, metal packaging provides for the safest food supply. When you get that canned food, you know that it is safe from foodborne illnesses because that metal packaging allows for high temperature heat sterilization. So a ban on an epoxy-coated material or a BCA-based material, which is not based on science, does not keep in mind the health interests of the citizens of Minnesota. When you talk about the science of BPA, this is something that has been researched and looked at by numerous independent expert panels around the world, which includes FDA, Health Canada, the European Food Safety Authority, Harvard Center for Risk Assessment. When you have a scientific debate, as you have here, the best way to answer that is to bring together experts in their field, come together who have no stake in the issue, have them come together, look at all of the research, and come to a conclusion. And that has happened over and over again, and the uses of BPA in food contact materials has been deemed safe over and over again. You look at the levels that we're talking about for canned liquid infant formula. These are low parts per billion. We're talking about less than a drop in a swimming pool. We're talking about a couple of seconds in thousands of years. That's what a part per billion is. These are levels that couldn't even be monitored or even seen just a few years ago. And as we continue to have better and better analytical techniques, we'll find other things that are in food at parts per billion, parts per trillion, parts per quadrillion. Does that make them unsafe? I say no. Some of the other things that have been talked about today, if you look at the bill as it's written, it talks about manufacturers must replace the materials that are, number one, not known to be a human carcinogen or identified by the federal EPA as causing birth defects, hormone disruption, or harm of human reproduction. Basically, what you're saying is you can replace BPA with BPA. It doesn't fit any of those criteria. So you're banning something where you're saying the alternatives have to meet this criteria, which BPA meets. A couple of other issues. It was mentioned that FDA has ignored over 100 studies on BPA. FDA last year put together a draft risk assessment where they determined that the uses of BPA was safe. They cited over 165 studies that they looked at, many of which they give detailed reasoning of why they were dismissed. For example, the common reason why studies are dismissed is because humans ingest orally BPA. So if you want to put together a study where you are injecting it into the bloodstream, you're giving it by some inappropriate means, you can find adverse effects. What does that mean to human health? Literally nothing. Those things are important and taken into consideration if, when you produce larger studies, you look at those effects and say, okay, what can that really mean when you expose people or animals to this orally? And to date, none of those studies that have shown adverse effects have been seen in those larger studies. It was also mentioned that the European Union is looking at this. Actually, the European Food Safety Authority, and in Europe they work on the precautionary principle, where if there's a question mark, they're going to ban that. The science is so sound on this issue that they have the lowest regulatory limit in the world, which is 600 parts per billion in the food. Here we're talking about an infant formula, low parts per billion, single digits, 1, 2, 3 parts per billion. The lowest regulatory limit in the world is 600 parts per billion. That has also been recommended by the European Food Safety Authority to be raised to 3,000 parts per billion based on all of the science.
Okay. Representative Gardner had a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Roth. I spent 10 years figuring out what to do with cans when people are done with them. I worked in recycling. So I would like to just ask you about what bisphenol A does in a metal container. It's part of an epoxy resin, but it isn't the resin itself. It's some sort of additive, right? And what does it functionally do inside the container?
Well, BPA, you know, people talk about BPA in contact with food. That's actually not technically correct. Okay. BPA is a monomer to make the polymer of an epoxy coating. As with all polymers, you start with one molecule, and they react and form this larger molecule that gives you that polymer. As with any chemical reaction, nothing goes to 100%. So there are small traces, again, these parts per billion of unreacted material that could migrate at, you know, in canned liquid infant form, you're talking about 1-2 parts per billion.
As a follow-up, so what's the polymer that's used in the, what do you call it?
It's an epoxy.
Okay, it's not like polybisphenol A or anything.
No, it's not.
And as a follow-up,
yes, Representative,
would it be fair to say, though, that if this bill went into effect, that you'd think that some of your customers would switch to another type of container like high-density polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate or some other plastic thing?
Well, and there are possibilities of switching to all the materials. I guess I have a couple comments to that. Who can guarantee that that material is any safer than the current material? We're talking about both FDA-approved materials. BPA is probably one of the most studied materials available. And when you talk about for different applications, there are, of course, other packaging alternatives, but when you look at the vast array of even of infant formula, if you go into a hospital and look at some of the applications there, you know, they have different bottles that they use. There are canned formulas for children who can't, you know, for example, digest carbohydrates. Those won't be changing these times. So that those materials won't be available in the state of Minnesota if this bill passes. Hospitals will likely be forced to have to mix powdered formula in hospitals, and they will tell you, anyone in a hospital will tell you, that's the worst place to be mixing formula. They want to open that cap, put a nipple on it, and feed it to the baby without exposing it to the environment as short amount of time as possible. So those things won't be available.
Representative Hayden.
I just have just a quick question for you, doctor. Are you a medical doctor or a PhD?
A PhD.
Can you tell me what your PhD is in?
It's in chemistry.
It's in chemistry. Okay.
Thank you. Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had exactly the same question.
Okay. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you brought up Health Canada and the European Food Safety Authority, just to put some of this in context, it said, from according to data from Health Canada, it said a 22-pound infant would have to drink 423 4-ounce bottles per day to reach that safe intake level. And then the European Food Safety Authority said a consumer would have to ingest more than 1,300 pounds of food and beverages in contact with polycarbonate every day for an entire lifetime to reach those same levels. Is that the context? Is that the data that you're talking about here, just to, that we can get our arms around this?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Laughlin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to get it on the record, and since the issue arose and there's been reference to Health Canada, I have here a copy of a Washington Post article that dated April 19, 2008, in which it said Canada yesterday became the first country to ban a widely found chemical from use in baby bottles, and it said that Walmart Canada began pulling all baby products containing BPA from its shelves this week. Playtech said it would offer non-BPA bottles to parents and exchange them. And so it does seem like the question of whether or not it's been banned in Canada.
No, the question is whether infant formula cans have been banned in Canada. No one is talking about baby bottles right now, I don't think.
I can produce a letter from Health Canada citing what they have asked for. And we are working, the North American Metal Packaging Alliance, in conjunction with the infant formula suppliers, are working on a project with Health Canada and FDA based on a request from Health Canada to guarantee that the levels of BPA in canned liquid infant formula are as low as reasonably achievable. So they understand the safety implications of an arbitrary ban. They're just saying, as they did with the baby bottle ban, which hasn't actually gone into effect. They proposed that. It hasn't. Right now, nowhere has it been banned. What they have said is, based on the availability of alternatives, taking into consideration all the safety, we would suggest that that can be replaced easily, so we're going to ban that. When it comes to canned liquid infant formula or any infant formula, they have not proposed a ban because they understand that the health implications would be far worse than this ban.
Okay, thank you. Representative Clark, you want to come back? And we have about 5 minutes. And Ms. Dahl, please come back. And thank you for coming. And it seems like the focus of the discussion here is primarily on the infant baby formula. No one seems to be raising questions so much about the other pieces of the ban. So if you want to address that, maybe.
Yeah, Ms. Dahl, to go ahead. She's done some of the
research. Yeah, that's great.
And you all do have in your packets, by the way, a document from Healthy Legacy that cites a number of studies. And I think one of the things that, after we finish talking a little bit more about that, the containers is just, as Dr. Meyer said, very tiny, minute amounts of exposure are some of the ones we're most concerned about when we talk about products that impact children's health. Ms. Dahlmatt, why don't you go ahead and talk about the formula.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. I just want to address a few of the things we just heard. First of all, the infant formula containers that I brought in today, I and parents that we work with, several people have called the company and asked if they had products that were 100% free of bisphenol A, and those are the two products that they cited time and time again. So that's straight from the company who told us that those products were BPA-free, just for a point of clarification.
Yep.
And then second of all, to address what Representative Kelly, you brought up about the amounts of BPA a child would have to consume in order to reach the safe threshold. First of all, the scientific community is questioning whether that safety threshold is actually adequate. So, second of all, the science is showing us that 1 to 2 parts per billion, for example, that the previous testifier noted that comes into infant formula containers is actually of concern. And here's something to just kind of put in context of why low doses matter for hormone-disrupting chemicals. So the hormone system is designed to work at very, very low levels. And although they're different, this is just for kind of a point of reference, birth control pills, the average oral contraceptive is administered at 0.035 parts per billion. And so it can stop a woman's ability to conceive at 0.035 parts per billion. So 1 to 2 parts per billion of a different synthetic estrogen, they're used differently, but it's significant. And so that's just a way to just show and describe that the hormone system, although these amounts sound really small, they're actually really significant. And what the science is showing us is confirming what endocrinologists, those that study the hormone system, have known for years. So just a point of clarification.
Any questions? Representative Norton.
I hate to raise this because it hasn't come up, but since the question's come up from the audience, I might as well raise it and then get it on the table. And that has to do with the children's product. When we're talking about children's product under on line 1.12, when you talk about introduced into and otherwise applied to the human body, would this apply to medical industry techniques or you know, I can't think of the right word, products that, and there were two examples that were raised, and I know there's been some discussion about the insulin pump, but also other tubing that is used for infants, as well as the issue of vaccines. And are those applicable, or are you going to deal with those in the future in this bill?
Representative Clark.
I'll speak to that because she helps with that amendment.
Ms. Phil.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. That's a good question. I know that the amendment that was added in line 1.15 to exempt a device, I know that the tubing is the issue that contains BPA for the insulin pumps, and that's why we included that in there. And we can double check to make sure that it's inclusive for all tubing. But that's my understanding, and if it's not, we can certainly address that.
That's it? All right. Seeing, you have a question? Okay. Seeing no further questions then, I guess I'll renew my motion that House File 326 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We're out to Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And we are adjourned.